Bob Tischler. The day that Michael was going to do his danger thing, he actually asked me not to come into the room, because he knew he was putting on a show and was going to be very theatrical. He knew I wouldn't have bought into it. It would have been very hard for me to sit through something like that. Michael lost a lot of people with that one. He was trying to shake everybody up, but there's always a second agenda with Michael. I have to categorize it as his own combination of sadistic and masochistic tendencies. Michael loved to play those roles, and he loved to be the focus of everything. There were certain periods where he would just break down and throw temper tantrums, breaking things, throwing things, screaming, and you just had to stay away from him. Michael really had something wrong with him, a chemical imbalance. He complained of migraine headaches all the time and would flip out occasionally. He was most interested in shocking the audience. I don't mind shocking the audience, but you have to make them laugh, too, and entertain them. He was really just into the shock value, or doing something that was weird and boring. I never called myself a writer before Saturday Night Live. I produced a lot of comedy, and I did writing, but I wasn't a member of the union or anything, and didn't go sit down and write. And when I came to Saturday Night Live, I was all of a sudden brought in as head writer. And what happened was, we did one show and the writer's strike happened. So at that point, it was an opportunity to basically clean house of the Gene Dumanian people that we didn't want and come back the next year with our own staff. There was an opportunity to upright the death ship and let it sail again. I've never been one to work on anything with the intent of it failing. But Michael would not give up on this death ship thing. So Michael and I kind of disagreed on that, and that's where we started to lose our friendship. At one point, Michael had been an incredible genius, an incredible writer. At a certain point, the panache and the desire to be recognized and to get the accoutrements of Saturday Night Live became more important than his craft. It was very sad for me to see this happen. James Downey. Lorne at that time was anxious to get into movies in a big way, and he had a deal with Paramount. And different writers and teams of writers, like Tom Schiller wrote a movie, each had movie ideas. Lorne was pushing Franken and Davis and myself the most to do a movie. But we didn't really have an idea. We had the deal before we had the idea, which is not a good way to do anything. So from like the summer of 1980, on and off for the next 2 years, we just in a desultory way wrote the screenplay, which once we finished it, Paramount was then able to officially reject. Then, like the summer of 82, Letterman had just started up in March, and he had asked me to come in when he was first putting his NBC late-night show together. I knew that I probably wouldn't be able to do it, at least in the very beginning, because of the movie thing. But I went in to meet him because I was a big fan of his morning show. And then in August we had finished up the movie, so I went to the Letterman show. Later I became head writer for about a year and a quarter. The biggest difference between writing for Letterman and writing for Saturday Night Live, well, obviously it would be the sketches, per se. I hope this doesn't sound pretentious, but I think that the principle in operation at Saturday Night Live seemed to be that, I didn't feel this way myself, but the principle was that we wanted to be hip, and at Letterman we wanted to be smart, and I liked that much better. It's not like I can identify even a single person at SNL who would say that being hip was what was most important to them. It was just that what made Saturday Night Live distinctive was not that it was so smart or brainy in that sense. It was more that, when it appeared, television had been kind of middle-aged and square for a long time. And Saturday Night Live set a tone of being cool. And certainly it was pretty clear that that was never a concern of the Letterman show. Brad Hall, cast member. I came in the second year of Ebersol, and we were there until the end of Ebersol. When Ebersol first started, he hired a bunch of people from Chicago, Mary Gross, Tim Kazurinsky, those guys, who we knew peripherally because we were from Chicago. And when we had the show in Chicago that we were doing next door to Second City, we shared the bar with Second City. And when Ebersol and Tischler came out to do their usual pilfering from Second City to get actors, they went to Second City, they saw the show, and the owner of Second City, who was sick of losing people to Saturday Night Live, said, "Hey, go next door, because we have a big hit show going on next door." and they came over and saw our show. And that night, right after the show, they said, "You're all hired. You're all coming to Saturday Night Live." It was very exciting. It was crazy. Julia and I were really lucky that we'd been going out for a while before that. We had a really solid relationship, and we came to the show together.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, cast member. Audition? No, we didn't do an audition, that's the thing. We were just hired off the show we did in Chicago. And then when we came to New York, Dick wanted us to do some of the material we'd done on stage. It was a real quirky show that we did. It was funny, but it was not straight down the middle improvisation comedy. And they made us perform a rather substantial section from the show. Dick set it up so that everybody sat on folding chairs, and the four of us performed sketches from our show for these jaded writers. It was just grotesque. It couldn't have been a more hostile crowd. It was so painful. I can't even believe I'm talking about it. There was no team spirit.
Brad Hall. It's a funny place to work, that 17th floor. People act as if it's so important that it's the only thing in the world. And the hours are ridiculous. But at the end of the day, how about just being funny? Those of us who didn't get so much material had a lot of time to hang out with the band. I spent a lot of time with the SNL band and with the guest bands. And when I look back, I think less about comedy and more about music, to tell you the truth. We got The Clash, we got Squeeze, we had Joe Jackson. Grant A. Tinker, former NBC chairman. I never visited their offices on the 17th floor. Never went up there once. I didn't want to go up there and fight my way through all that marijuana smoke, which I'd been led to believe was quite thick. So I felt, why cause trouble? Jack Handy, writer. I went over to this house one time for a Halloween party, and Cheryl Hardwick was playing the piano, and they had a Poe reading. And then Michael O'Donohue announced that he was going to unveil this painting by a new young artist that he had discovered. And so we were all sucked into it. Like, here's the artist, supposedly, and he's standing there and looking kind of embarrassed. And the name of the painting is Desi Arnaz as a Young Man. There were, I don't know, 30 or 40 people there. So the painting is up on the wall, and Michael pulls off the cover and he goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Desi Arnaz as a Young Man." And there's the painting. Big oil painting, and sure enough, it is Desi Arnaz as a young man, seated on a chair facing you, but with female genitalia instead of male. And there was just an audible gasp from the room. That was the kind of thing Michael liked to do.
Judith Belushi, writer. I did a little writing, but only on one show, when Dick Ebersol came in. The first year there was a writer's strike, and we only did one show. John said to me, "Why would you ever want to write for Saturday Night Live?" And I said that I had been around it so much, and sometimes had even participated, giving somebody a line or something. And I'd worked on the National Lampoon Radio Hour and other things. So I thought, I can do that. And I thought it would be interesting. But I really didn't like it. I call it my week in television. It was actually 3 weeks of working.
Tim Kazurinsky. It was too crazy. Everyone was out of control. Finally, I decided to quit the show. I called John Belushi and said, "I'm going home. I'm flying back to Chicago tonight. I quit." Pam Norris, Blaustein, a few others, and I were pretty much coming up with the show almost every week. O'Donohue's writers were hopeless. They did nothing. When they did do something, it was horrible. But I didn't get to quit because John said, "Okay, Judy and I will drive you to the airport." They came by my house, got my bags, and instead of taking me to the airport, they took me to a psychiatrist. John said, "If you want to quit that show, you've got to be crazy." He told me, "Here's the thing you can't lose sight of. It gets bad, it gets ugly, but you're an improviser, you're a writer, you have access to network airwaves. You have a chance to reach some hearts and minds out there. You have a chance to say something. You cannot walk away from this." And he sent me into this psychiatrist, who I saw every week for the next year and who kept me healthy enough to stay on the show. Bob Tischler. There was a lot of lying going on, a lot of deception, and it became furious between O'Donohue and Ebersol. I kept on trying to defend him. Ebersol really wanted to get rid of him a long time before he did. I had known Michael for years before the show. He and I were great friends, and actually ended up not remaining friends as a result of our experience on Saturday Night Live together. Michael had this history with everybody. Anybody who really got close to him ended up being on his enemies list at a certain point. Elliot Wald, writer. I hit it off badly with Michael. He passed judgment on things. He and my first partner, Nate Herman, he didn't like Nate too much, and since Nate was a performer, he was always hilarious in meetings. So it was hard for him to fire on Nate, but Nate's quiet partner was easier to pick on. I was afraid to speak up at meetings in the first half of the season. He had made life difficult for me. He almost got me fired. Just get him out of here, because he was trying to get somebody else hired. But before that could be executed, he got himself fired over the Silverman in the Bunker piece. This was a piece he wrote, with Silverman as Hitler in the last days. The sketch didn't make it to air, and that's why Michael quit, or put himself in the position to be fired. He talked to somebody in the press about what a bunch of morons everybody up there was, how they couldn't see the brilliance of this piece. And the network said, "Well, you do have a clause in your contract about doing things like that." So they fired him. He was asking for it. He was, in essence, quitting. But Michael and I made our peace after the show. We did a couple of panels together at the Museum of Television and Radio, and actually were on pretty pleasant terms. Then the shock came when he died.
Robin Schlynn, production assistant. When Michael O'Donohue got fired, he left this amazing note. "I was fired by Dick Ebersol. I did not leave the show, and if he should claim otherwise, he is, to steal a phrase from Louisa May Alcott, a lying cunt." It's very Michael. He posted it on the wall. Dick wasn't in yet, so those of us who were there immediately took it off and Xeroxed it and made copies, knowing that Dick would rip it down, which he did. But it survived.
Bob Tischler. There were two wakes for Michael. The one on the East Coast was the original, official wake, and they actually had the graph of his aneurysm from the MRI. And then they had a second wake at the Cafe Formosa in Los Angeles. You have to realize that a lot of people who were once friends or who once worked together, who had lots of issues between them, were suddenly in a room together. When anybody dies, everybody gets pulled together whether they like to or not. At Michael's wake, there were a lot of egos flying. A lot of people needed to be the center of attention. Jack Handy. I went to Michael's wake. There was food and drink, and his wife Cheryl was there, and toward the end of the evening people got up and sort of talked, telling stories about Michael. They had put the X-rays of his head up as decorations, so people could see where he had his massive stroke, or something like that. There was some controversy after Lorne and Chevy Chase spoke. Buck Henry got up and said something to the effect that it was interesting that they got up to speak, when I think we all know what Michael thought of them. Lorne Michaels. That's the blackest period for me. Buck later wrote me one of the most beautiful notes I ever received in my life, in which he said, a year or two later, that at the time there were attack dogs running at me and he had joined the pack, and he apologized. What happened was, Michael died on a Tuesday. He'd gone into St. Vincent's Hospital on Monday. My son Eddie was born on Wednesday before read-through in the same hospital. Friday night was a wake that I helped organize at Cheryl's. After visiting the hospital and going to the studio around 11 o'clock, I went to the wake with Chevy Chase. He and John were not on the best of terms, but on another level really loved each other. Meanwhile, John was considered the real deal in Hollywood, and Chevy was, well, you know. I remembered a time before all these people had joined the Belushi camp. They had been professionally in the John Belushi business. Then they switched over to the Michael O'Donohue business. And somebody in their remarks took a shot at Chevy, as if you had to make a choice between loving Michael and loving Chevy.
Jane Curtin, cast member. The fact that here we all were, our lives forever intertwined, and you had these love-hate relationships with people, and things got said that were just so incredibly perfect and mean and funny and honest. Some people laughed, some people gasped. It was pretty cool.
Andrew Kurtzman. I came into the show through Tim Kazurinsky. He brought in several of us. My father had been a creative director at Leo Burnett in Chicago, and Tim had been in his creative group along with Jeff Price, who went on to be a screenwriter. A couple of playwrights and a lot of odd people came out of that agency. I was an accidental hire. I wrote Tim a funny letter asking for tickets to the show. Tim said, "This is quite funny. You should write a couple of sample sketches." And I won't say I dashed them off, but I wrote a bunch of sketches and then went back to a $90-a-week job at Barnes & Noble. I forgot the whole thing for about 2 months. And then I began to get these strange phone calls at odd hours in the middle of the night from Kaz, saying things like, "Blaustein loved the stuff." Shortly thereafter, I was brought in. Brad Hall. Dick didn't really have a lot to say about the comedy. He would sort of go into the room and pick the sketches. It was much more like he was a judge than he was involved in the process at all. I noticed very quickly that on Wednesdays, when we had these gigantic read-throughs, that the very funniest sketch at the table would almost always get in the show. But so would the worst sketch. Dick Ebersol. The sets were made in Brooklyn in those days, and then they had to be broken down so they could fit on an elevator, whereas, you know, everything on the West Coast is horizontal. I mean, the big studios. They make the sets in one end of the building. They can be as big as you want. You push them down the hallway. The studio doors open up. They're 30 or 40 feet high, and the thing wheels in. With Saturday Night Live, everything has to fit into one of those small Rockefeller Center elevators. And so not only does it take a while to build the set, you have to then build it in such a way it can be broken down and then reassembled. So, from the end of read-through, you go back in a room and pick the elements of the show you want to take to dress. I think one difference between Lorne and me was that I never wanted to go to dress more than 3 sketches too long. He has stronger feelings about the ability to repair things late. So he oftentimes will go to dress much longer than that. I mean, he'll go a half hour or 40 minutes longer going to dress, and obviously it's worked for him for a quarter of a century. I was more comfortable being about 3 long, but that's the big thing that you're facing, that Wednesday night deadline, because of the sets. Don Novello, writer. This was an amazing thing. I'm not sure of the year, but I would say early 80s. Bill Murray was hosting. I was a guest as a performer, and I really was like a writer for him. And at the end of the show, everyone's going up on stage to say goodnight, and there's a commercial break, 2 minutes, 4 minutes, whatever. And during the break, Ebersol suddenly comes running up and says, "It's on the news. Russia's invading Poland, and you should announce it." Bill said, "What should I do?" And I told him, wisely, as it turns out, "That's a news thing. This is a comedy show. Why would you want to do it?" Ebersol says, "Come on, we've got 30 seconds. You're going to do it." Well, I was not going to stand there when he announced it, so I went and stood way in the back, even though I was one of the main guests. So Bill announced it to America that Russia had invaded Poland, and the poor people of Poland, our hearts go out to them. It was really almost teary-eyed. And it didn't happen. The invasion didn't happen, at least not that night. But I guess Ebersol wanted this to be on the comedy show that broke it to America that Russia invaded Poland. Andrew Smith. Dick was tremendously successful with the network. He could get anything out of the network, whether it was money or one thing or another. He understands network politics and that side of it, you know, better than anybody else. And of course his best friend was Brandon Tartikoff, which didn't hurt. He was brilliant at that side of being an executive producer. But he obviously wasn't a comedy writer and was somewhat foreign to comedy, although I guess there are some issues as to whether he invented the show with Lorne or not. Fred Silverman. There are very few people who can produce that show. I never got along particularly well with Ebersol, but I think he did a pretty good job, actually. He walked into a real mess and kept it going, to his credit. The show had had its ups and downs, but he managed to hang in there. Dick Ebersol. It was like a war, and most of it was about the fact that Fred just didn't like having a show that had that level of freedom that was attacking Fred. Saturday Night Live does not work if it censors itself about its own company. You have to attack. I made a point, the very first show I did by myself, in April of 81, of letting Franken do a piece on Update. We were friends, but deep inside he thought he should produce the show, and I let him do a piece on Update, the sum of which was that Dick doesn't know Dick. David Sheffield. Ebersol is a guy who walks the halls slapping a baseball bat into his palm. He is not easily intimidated. We were at a meeting one time, 20 minutes until air, and this pipsqueak guy from the network says, "I just think we really ought to..." And Dick turned around and said to him, "Just shut the fuck up and sit in the corner." He ran a fence between us and the network. He kept the wolves away while we did the show. This is a good executive strategy. His great strength as producer of the show is he didn't try to do comedy. He left that up to us. Brad Hall. My big run-in with Dick came when there was this very funny sketch that got cut for time, and he said, "Don't worry, we'll do it next week." And then, of course, it wasn't on the board the next week, and so I said, "You said we'd do it next week." And he denied having said it, of course. I'm a very even-tempered guy, but once in a while I'll get mad. I was absolutely an offense, because it just wasn't true. And good old Mary Gross, to her credit, goes, "We were all there, we all heard it." It was typical. I think everybody had things like that. Grant A. Tinker. I had so many larger problems that had to be dealt with that I just didn't get around to Saturday Night Live. And no one was the worse for wear as the result. The show went on, and I did what I did, and just because the twain never met, it wasn't advertent on my part. I guess you could say it was inadvertent.
Pam Norris. I did not find Dick difficult to work for. I did not agree with a lot of his decisions, but he had what to me is a magical quality in a boss, in that I felt like I could say anything to him. And I really quite often said very harsh things. He was okay with that. I never felt like he was going to be angry with me if I told him something he didn't like. I really am glad in a lot of ways to have dealt with Dick, because I never felt like he was some kind of royalty and that I needed to curry his favor somehow.
Tim Kazurinsky. Somebody pointed out to me at read-throughs that Ebersol didn't really know what was funny. He would look over to Davy Wilson, the director, for some sort of indication. And of course Davy had done the show for so long that he was very tired. He only cared if it was easy to shoot. If it was difficult, he would just move his head from side to side, and Ebersol would kill it. So he took a lot of lead from Davy. Andrew Smith. His real name is Duncan Dickie Ebersol. He used to have a Dutch boy haircut. He would come to the office dressed like he was going to a country club. Golf sweaters, plaid madras pants, that kind of stuff. He certainly had no embarrassment about being a WASP. It was really fascinating. It's as if he hadn't been down in the city very long. When I first started working with him, he had this thing about contractions. I think his mother put the fear of God into him and told him that nice people don't use contractions. I cannot even do an imitation. But if you can think of talking without ever using a contraction, you will be able to assume what it is that I am talking about. It made him sound like a foreigner. And then he had this thing that you don't talk a certain way in front of women. You know, you had better get that woman out of here before we talk about that. He wouldn't swear in front of them. He wouldn't say fuck or shit or anything like that. Or he'd spell it out or use a euphemism. He was much more comfortable in the company of men, which is not to make any kind of sexual aspersions. Women were sacrosanct to him. Jim Belushi, cast member. I supposedly threw a fire extinguisher at Ebersol. I don't remember throwing it at him. I remember going down the hall and getting really pissed and grabbing the fire extinguisher off the wall and heaving it toward his office. I was a hungry, aggressive young man. I was a pain in the ass to Ebersol, but not to the other actors. Ebersol didn't even really hire me. Brandon Tartikoff was always a fan of mine, and he saw me do a big Second City benefit show that started the John Belushi Scholarship Fund. We invited everybody in the industry, and every studio gave like $7,500. Brandon saw that show, and I did quite a few Second City routines there, and he said to Dick, "Why don't you hire Belushi?" And Ebersol goes, "You think so?" Brandon said, "Yeah, he was really funny." So Ebersol did. Tim Kazurinsky. The thing with Ebersol was that he was always looking for the lowest common denominator. The moral majority was really big then, and he didn't want to do anything to piss anybody off or do anything controversial. I had just come out of Second City, and he tells me, "I don't want to do political things. I don't want to do controversial things. Who do you do impersonations of? Can you do Mickey Rooney?" I was like, "Fuck off." I remember John Candy's saying that was like the bottom of the comedy barrel, Mickey Rooney. Barry Blaustein. Reagan's election set the tone. There was a kind of impending doom hanging over the country, and there was palpably a move toward conservatism at the network. We tried ideas for sketches that the network would shoot down. The censors would say, "You can't do that." We'd point out they did something similar with Aykroyd 3 years earlier, and the censor would say, "Yeah, but that was then. This is now. Things are different." There was to be no mention of the Iran hostage crisis. Ironically, when the crisis was over, we did a whole show with every hostage sketch we could think of. David Sheffield. Barry had an idea for a great hostage sketch, which was, a guy knows this woman's husband is being held hostage, and he goes over to console her and winds up hitting on her. The network said no. It was a strange time. James Downey. I liked Dick Ebersol a lot. He gets a bad rap. He developed a playbook to run the show, which I would argue they are definitely using these days. The way the show works now is Ebersol's formula. The popular characters in heavy rotation, the kind of pieces they pick. It's not a writer's show. Ebersol made no bones. "I'm pushing Eddie Murphy. There's going to be a Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood or a Buckwheat every other show in alteration. I'm going to pretend the whiners are popular characters, whether the audience thinks so or not. And we're going to keep doing it. It's going to be about the performers. The sets are going to be very simple." I think Ebersol kept the show on the air at a point where it might have been canceled. It's like Sam Houston holding the Texas Army together long enough to hang on. Andrew Kurtzman. Tim Kazurinsky, who came from a business environment, sort of clued me in by saying, "Watch Ebersol. Watch how he leaves the door opened or closed during a meeting. Watch who he has in his office." What was it they said about Lyndon Johnson? He never had a telephone conversation without needing to win a point. Even when Dick was yelling, he was subtly turning things so that the argument would go his way. Elliot Wald. I don't remember who said the line. I've said it so much that someone said they thought I said it originally, but I didn't. But one of the writers said, "Every time somebody in the world lies, Dick Ebersol gets a royalty." Bob Tischler. I had one big run-in with Dick before our last year. I said, "I know you're a publicity hog and you can't control yourself, but at least give me some kind of credit for this. I'm doing all the work. I think you should be much more in the background." He was dealing with the network and dealing with a lot of the nuts and bolts, and I was really running the show much more from the creative point of view, because he really did not have a good rapport with the writers. So I would do all the rewriting, and that would be a hell of a lot of work, but he would just take all the credit. And I was very troubled by it, and told him so. At one point, I was going to leave the show. He was thinking of firing me, I was thinking of walking out. But we came together and settled it, so I stayed. I ended up liking working with him a lot, because he is an excellent producer. He really knows how to deal with the network more than anybody I've ever met. It's just that he had a lot of shortcomings in knowing how to deal with creative people. Dick is a very strange animal. Andrew Kurtzman. The toughest it ever got between me and Dick was at one point he said, "You're talking pretty big for a guy who was making $90 last week." That's sort of a Dickensian moment in my life. I had to get between Dick and a couple of people several times. With Dick, there was always an element of fear, like his argument with Andy Kaufman. I was standing there backstage when they screamed at each other. There was a certain amount of "fuck you" and screaming down the little entranceway leading into the studio there. It was a big confrontation. It was the show where Andy was voted off the air. I will say Dick was always in control. Even when Dick was out of control, Dick was perfectly in control. Elliot Wald. There was one piece I remember very well that Jim Downey wrote that we were falling off our chairs about. It was hilarious. It was an alien spaceship landing on Earth. The aliens come out and say, "We are superior. You shouldn't even bother to oppose us." And it becomes obvious as they talk that they stole the spaceship and haven't really read the manual or anything and really don't know how to run it very well. And in 4 minutes, it just had half a dozen wonderfully funny things. I remember that piece, and there were a million like it, where Dick just didn't get it. The writers all got it. Dick didn't. Tim Kazurinsky. I had done this running thing called I Married a Monkey, where my wife was played by a live chimpanzee. And I did it because I knew that something would screw up and people would see that it was live. People would always ask me, "When do you tape the show?" No, it's called Saturday Night Live. It's live. It became so slick people forgot that it was live. So I thought, I'll do this soap opera thing with a live chimp, and inadvertently I'll get to improvise. And it got to be very popular. And anything that took off, Ebersol wanted. Let's do that again, you know? Let's do another monkey thing. Even when you think it's played out, you still have to do them. We need a monkey for this week. And I'd go, Christ! And we used to hire these midget chimps, Butch and Peppy, because they supposedly worked with Ronald Reagan in Bedtime for Bonzo. And the trainer told me one time, "Watch out for the chimps. When the hairs go up on their arms, they're ready to attack." So I was on the show one night. It was dress, and Madge, my wife, is in a hospital bed with amnesia. So I'm sitting there next to her, and suddenly I see the hairs on her arm go up. And I make this dash trying to get out of there, and she grabs me and gets my head in a headlock that was like steel. Fortunately, she was tethered by a chain at the back of the hospital bed, and I was able to pull my head free before she crushed my skull. Then she went berserk and ripped off her leopard-skin negligee and diaper and revealed to the audience that Madge was really a male chimp. So, standing there on the bed now, he grabs his monkey member and starts masturbating, as if to say, "I'm a guy." Out in the audience, mothers are shielding their kids' eyes, and I thought, oh God, if this ever happened on air, I'd probably have stayed and wrestled with the chimp. But for a dress rehearsal, get the hell out of there. So they sedated the chimp for the air show. I look over and he's just totally glassy-eyed. And the next time I worked with a chimp, its teeth had been removed. Then I found out from a production assistant that Ebersol was secretly taking out, like, massive amounts of insurance on me when I worked with the chimp. And that's when I said, no more, I'm not doing it anymore. I thought, he's taking $1 million of insurance in case I get killed. And fuck that, it's too bizarre. I mean, I'm not going to die for him. Jim Belushi. Ebersol's an executive network manager. He's one of the tops in that field. I think he knew what worked and what didn't work, and I think he really knew how to program the first 30 minutes to be the most successful. He knew the first 30 minutes of the show was the most watched, so he really kind of messed around with the commercials to try to hold them back. As far as being a writer or a comic and telling you, why don't you try this gag, he was a little dry that way. Ebersol is like a lot of people in our industry. They're heat-seeking missiles. What they're looking for is the heat. He put that heat up there in the first 30 minutes. Sometimes, though, people like that don't know how to nurture something. Joe Piscopo. The Sinatra stuff was early on, and they had to talk me into that because I didn't want to disrespect my hero. When I first started doing him, I wrote him a letter and I sent him an album through his attorney, We put out this I love rock and roll, Sinatra sings the rock tunes kind of thing. I was a North Jersey Italian-American, just like the old man, as we affectionately referred to Mr. S., and he couldn't have been nicer. Matter of fact, he sent out cease and desist letters to anybody who'd even think of doing him, and he never sent me a letter. And he used to call me Giuseppe, which was Italian for Joseph. He would invite me to everything. He just liked it. And when I look at it now, it had a real edge to it, you know? But he couldn't have been nicer, and I have the fondest memories, rest his soul, of the old man. He was just the greatest. When I first did him on SNL, he was at Caesar's Palace in Atlantic City, and he was about to step on stage. The opening act was an old comic named Charlie Callis, and everybody was waiting for the old man, and at 11:30, for the first time, it was me doing him, and everybody stopped in the room, and I heard this from everybody, and they just said, "How is this guy crazy enough to do Sinatra?" And Callis breaks his silence and says to the old man, "What do you think, Captain?" And Sinatra looks at me doing him, and he says, "He's pretty good, the little prick." And when I met him, he said, "Hey, Joe Baby, come here." I felt so comfortable, I said, "Can I call you Frank?" He said, "No." It was great, you know? He was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. Bob Tischler. We had a piece on one show where people were jumping off a building, and in the sketch Frank Sinatra was supposed to jump, as was Mayor Koch, who played himself. And Joe says, "Frank wouldn't jump off a building." And Eddie turns to him and says, "Oh yeah, and Mayor Koch would?" That was one of my many Frank wouldn't do that stories. There was another time when Billy Crystal was going to play Sammy Davis Jr. Billy and I wrote this piece, and Joe was supposed to play Frank, and it was supposed to start in the Carnegie Deli and end up where Sammy would breakdance in front of the NBC studios, which we did. But when we told Joe that we wanted to start in the Carnegie Deli, he said that Frank would never eat in the Carnegie Deli, and he refused to do it until we put Frank in a limo. Then there's the Stevie Wonder story. It was a sketch called Ebony and Ivory, and it was supposed to be Frank Sinatra and Stevie Wonder, Joe and Eddie. In the sketch, which Barry and David wrote, Frank was supposed to be waiting for Stevie Wonder to show up at the recording studio, and Joe said, "Frank wouldn't wait for Stevie. Stevie would have to wait for Frank," and refused to do it that way. It was sick. Andrew Smith. Joe needed to think he was Frank Sinatra. All that stuff about Frank. And we wanted to write a sketch called Frank Wouldn't Do That, because we'd pitch a sketch or something and Joe would say, "No, no, Frank wouldn't do that." I once wrote a sketch, The Gay Frank Sinatra Club, and, "No, not that, Frank wouldn't do that." So he really got a little squirrely about this whole Frank thing. Joe saw his Frank thing not in comedy terms, but as a tribute. Tim Kazurinsky. I always said I would love to have done SCTV. There were smarter producers and smarter people involved. Watching the talent wither on Saturday Night Live, that was painful. You had really good writers trying to dumb down and getting depressed about it and turning to drugs. Good performers, Mary Gross, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Robin Duke, were given so little to do on the show that their confidence eroded. Robin Duke was hysterical in shows at Second City, and they gave her nothing. And the less they give somebody, well, you know what they say. If you have one line, it's harder than if you have a big part. The confidence erodes week by week, and it can just destroy people. And that was a hard thing to watch. The Second City environment was much more nurturing back then, and to come from that into the Saturday Night Live snake pit was not pleasant. Andrew Smith. If Joe thought he'd done a bad show, well, I remember one time sitting in Ebersol's office and Joe went around the corner into Ebersol's bathroom and started banging his head against the wall in the shower. And there was this thud as, you know, he's thumping his head against the wall. And his wife, his first wife, this long-suffering, very sweet, mild girl, turned to us and said, "Joe is such a perfectionist. Poor Joe, he's such a perfectionist." What? Thud, thud, thud. Jim Belushi. Let me put it this way. Those 2 years of Saturday Night Live, 83 to 84 and 84 to 85, were the toughest years I've ever spent in show business. Everything has been easy since. If you were a young physician and they threw you into Cook County Hospital or Bellevue for 2 years, that's what I equate it to. I'm really glad I did it. I'm very proud to be part of the legacy of Saturday Night Live. The only thing I regret is I didn't have 2 more years to really kind of hit that full fruition of it. Even my brother John left after 4 years. I said, "John, what are you doing leaving? It's like the hottest thing going." He goes, "Well, you know, Jimmy, it's like high school. Freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year. And then you've got to move on." Dick Ebersol's initial version of Saturday Night Live was efficient and commercial, but fundamentally uninspired. It had little soul or spark, except for that provided by one magnificently conspicuous member of the cast, the man whom Dumanian had failed to feature. Now, allied with two of the show's best writers, Blaustein and Sheffield, Eddie Murphy blossomed forth during the Ebersol regime. He was fresh, funny, electrifying. He lit up the screen. Audiences who had wearied of the show's sameness and dropped away were lured back to see this spectacular new kid in town. Murphy had another loyal ally, or perhaps fervent disciple, in cast member Joe Piscopo. Off-screen, Murphy and Piscopo played the role of campus cut-ups, though to some observers Piscopo seemed sycophantic in his adulation of Murphy and basked to the baking point in Murphy's refracted glow. And more than one insider reportedly remarked, "Eddie Murphy's success went to Joe Piscopo's head." Brian Doyle Murray, cast member. Eddie Murphy wasn't too happy. He wasn't being used when he first started, and then he proved himself and he moved up. He was trying to get a spot on there at first, and they weren't really giving him a shake. I always liked Eddie, yeah. Yeah, in fact, when Del Close came to teach improv, Eddie wasn't too up for that. He went, "Hey, I'm funny, I don't have to learn that shit." Neil Levy. I had this tape of Elvis Presley's 1968 comeback concert, where he wore that black leather jumpsuit thing, and Eddie used to come in and watch that over and over, and a few years later, he was wearing black leather. I also remember sitting in the bathroom, and you could see in pencil on the wall, "Eddie Murphy number one," and as he got famous, it got bigger. He put it in bigger writing and switched from pencil to pen. He told me when he was 19 that he was going to be a millionaire before he was 21. He said that to me. I never met anybody so sure that once he got his foot in the door, he was going all the way.
Marilyn Suzanne Miller, writer. Eddie Murphy had been some kind of a part-time guy under Dumanian, and Michael and I screened something, or saw some of his work, and Dick went, "This guy is unreal. He's got to be on the air." And we met with Eddie, and Eddie was very quiet. You know if you're great. And he just seemed to be saying, "Yeah, I'm great. What do you want to do?"